Now that I'm done playing Duck Duck Goose, we can start today's episode. For Herodotus, known as the father of history, the Greek religion was mostly an Egyptian import. In fact, Herodotus wrote that the Spartans arrived in Greece from Egypt. The Spartans are also noted for celebrating new moons, an Israelite practice, and the seventh day of the month, which some researchers postulate could be a corruption of worship on the seventh day of the week. In any event, the number 7 holds esoteric significance, as do the numbers 3 and 12, all of which are interwoven throughout the Bible. In fact, the Hebrew language itself is composed of 3 mother letters, 7 double letters, and 12 simple letters. In some of my prior videos, when I was interpreting the symbolism of alchemy during the Renaissance, I pointed out that the number 3 was understood to represent the masculine and appeared as a triangle, and the number 4 represented the feminine and could be symbolically portrayed as a square. Adding 3 plus 4 gives us 7, the number of perfection and creation, as is depicted in this 16th century drawing with a man and a woman inside of a circle surrounded by a square and a triangle. Incidentally, G is the 7th letter of the alphabet, which is why it is revered by Freemasons, whose lower ranks claim that it stands for generative principle, geometry, grand architect, or God, but learn about numbers and sacred geometry and the Kabbalah at the higher levels. Of course, when we multiply 3 and 4, we get 12, which represents the number of lines that make up a cube, the symbolic shape of the universe in certain occult schools of thought. It is for this reason that in astronomy, or astrotheology, Jupiter was chosen as the king of the gods, as it has a roughly 12-year orbit around the sun and passes through the 12 houses of the zodiac, which mainstream historians claim started with the Babylonians, but in actuality goes back into the Pleistocene, or Ice Age, passed down by the first people that anthropologists regard as being fully modern, known as Cro-Magnon.
At first sight, the night sky is made up of thousands of stars arranged randomly. But when you look closer, some stars are more visible than others. They're brighter. These stars were recorded very early on in history. The Babylonians grouped them into 12 constellations, the constellations of the zodiac. If you observe the sky long enough, the stars appear to move around an imaginary axis, running through the North Pole. Did Paleolithic man observe this phenomenon, picking out groups of stars, and then mentally project the images of familiar animals onto underground walls? The cave might be far more than a gallery of 600 odd paintings. The very shape of this dome, the belt of the zodiac in the sky. One figure, a large bull and the Aldebaran star.
If the hall of the bulls were in glass, you would see the constellations behind them.
If the ancient Egyptian history, as told by the classical Greeks, is true, then the Mediterranean world was attacked 11,500 years ago by a force coming from outside of the Pillars of Hercules, meaning from the Atlantic, and this seafaring power would have likely been comprised of descendants of Cro-Magnon. When one looks at a map of Cro-Magnon's settlements during the Pleistocene, they appear along Western Europe and Western North Africa, with the museum that boasts having the most Cro-Magnon skulls in the world being on the Canary Islands in the Atlantic, whose native population, called the Guanches, are not only acknowledged as being direct descendants of Cro-Magnon in encyclopedias, such as Britannica, but share genetic affinities with the Basque and Berbers, two native populations that both maintain legends of origins from Atlantica or Atlantis. According to Plato, the ancient Egyptian priests told the Greeks, quote, "Many great and wonderful deeds are recorded of your state in our histories, but one of them exceed all of the rest in greatness and valor. This vast power endeavored to subdue at a blow our country and yours and the whole of the region within the straits, and then your country shone forth in the excellence of her virtue and strength among all mankind. She was preeminent in courage and military skill and was the leader of the Hellenes. And when the rest fell off from her, being compelled to stand alone after having undergone the very extremity of danger, she defeated and triumphed over the invaders and preserved from slavery those not yet subjugated and generously liberated all the rest of us who dwell within the pillars." We are told that after the Atlantean invaders were defeated, massive cataclysms inundated their homeland, submerging it below the rapidly rising sea level at the close of the Pleistocene, or Ice Age. These natural disasters occurred while many Atlanteans were in the Mediterranean, effectively becoming stranded as refugees, or presumably becoming captives of the Athenian victors, which brings us back to the Spartans, who Herodotus claims arrived to the Peloponnese from Egypt. While Sparta was considered an ancient Greek city-state, they were not unified with the natives and even subjugated many of them, known as Helots, whose name means captives. They were essentially a conquered people who the Spartans turned into slaves. While the Spartans were immortalized in the movie 300 as fighting off the Persian invaders, this was not always the case, as for a period they were allied with the Persians against the Athenians and other Greek city-states. This speaks to the division among the demographics of the ancient Mediterranean, which classical writers and sources, such as the Bible, agree with archaeological evidence as being a continuation of an ancient conflict. The Greek poet Homer wrote about a seafaring tribe called Danoi, or Danann, who fought alongside the Greeks at the Battle of Troy. The biblical tribe of Dan was known as a seafaring tribe, which the Bible directly relates with Greece. In Ezekiel, Javan is the Hebrew name for Greece. So an Egyptian or Israelite connection with the Mycenaean world is nothing new. According to Greek legend, the patriarch of the Danoi tribe was Danaus, son of Belus, who likewise came to Greece from Egypt, fleeing from his brother or ruler, Aegyptus.
"The old ones say we Spartans are descended from Hercules himself. Bold Leonidas gives testament to our bloodline."
The most famous Danoi descendant was the strongman Hercules. This individual is actually a close parallel to the famous strongman from the tribe of Dan, Samson. Both killed a lion with their bare hands. Both are responsible for the death of their first wives in a fire. Both single-handedly wiped out armies. Both faced off against enemies fielding giants. Both are known for their signature use of club weapons. Both are associated with multi-headed canines as well as snakes. Both drank water that miraculously came from a rock. Both tore down the gates of a city, both had a weakness for women, and both unwittingly met their demise at the hands of a lover who betrayed them, Samson by Delilah, Hercules by Deianira. While Hercules and Samson were not the same, they seemed to share the same ancient Near Eastern hero motif, stemming from the same tradition of astrotheology, which is found in the Mesopotamian Enkidu as well, from the Epic of Gilgamesh. contrary to general belief, the Jews represent only a fraction of the Israelites, let alone all of the descendants of Abraham. All Jews are Israelites, but most Israelites are not Jews. In fact, the first time the word Jews is mentioned in the Bible is in a passage describing a battle between the Jews and the Israelites. Rather than being a single population, the Israelites divided themselves into 12 tribes, sort of the way the first American settlements divided themselves into colonies. That said, a letter dated to the 3rd century BC from the Spartan king Arius to the Jewish ruler Onias claimed that both people shared a common ancestry, as presented by 1st century historian Josephus in his book Antiquities of the Jews. Quote, "We have met with a certain writing whereby we have discovered that both the Jews and the Lacedaemonians are of one stock and are derived from the kindred of Abraham. It is but just therefore that you, who are our brethren, should send to us about any of your concern as you please. We will also do the same thing and esteem your concerns as our own, and we will look upon our concern as in common with yours. The Motilese who brings you this letter will bring your answer back to us. This letter is four square, and the seal is an eagle with a dragon in his claws." With that in mind, let's take a closer look at Sparta. Sparta is a city in Laconia on the Peloponnese in Greece. The Peloponnese is the peninsula region in southern Greece separated from the central part of the country. Sparta was unique in ancient Greece for its social system and constitution, completely focused on military training and excellence. Sparta reached the height of its power in 404 BC after its victory against Athens in the Second Peloponnesian War. When it was in its prime, Sparta had no city walls. The men became the walls of Sparta. Hoplites were citizen soldiers of ancient Greek city-states, and none were more feared than the professional and well-trained Spartan hoplites. The only people who could have a gravestone were women who died in childbirth and warriors who died in battle. Both were considered lives given for the state. In Greek mythology, Helen of Troy, also known as Helen of Sparta, was said to have been the most beautiful woman in the world, who was married to a Spartan king but eloped with the Prince of Troy, resulting in the famous Trojan War, where the Achaeans, or Greeks, set out to reclaim her and bring her back to Sparta. Helen was believed to have been the daughter of Zeus, and why the Greeks called themselves Hellenes. The Achaeans were the descendants of Achaeus, grandson of Helen, the father of all Greeks. The ancient Greek poet Pindar wrote that the hair of the Achaeans was blonde. Bacchylides also wrote that the hair of the Spartans was blonde. Pyrrha, the mother of Helen, was said to have red, golden hair. The Spartans were also known as the Dorians and claimed descent from Hercules. According to Euripides, Hercules was yellow-haired. Contrary to popular belief, Spartans valued knowledge and education at least as much as the Athenians did. Although Athens has been praised as the inventor of democracy and philosophy, Sparta had its own democratic government, one in which women could own land and have their voices heard. Although Spartan women were not active in the military, they were educated and enjoyed unprecedented status and freedom compared to other women of ancient Greece. The Spartan hoplite followed a strict code of honor, no soldier was considered superior to another. Sparta placed the values of liberty, equality, and fraternity at the center of their ethical system, and worshipped Athena as their patron goddess. Like the Spartans, the Romans identify the city's founders with Hercules. Minerva was the Etruscan or Roman counterpart to the Greek Athena. And while the Greeks and Romans were considered polytheistic civilizations, meaning they worshipped many gods, both of these ancient cultures also had mystery schools, which provided for an esoteric interpretation of polytheism, which when subjectively studied, looks a lot more like monotheism than someone uninitiated would expect. Sacrifices or offerings formed the chief part of the worship of the ancients. Human sacrifices are very frequently mentioned. In fact, the mythology of Greece is full of instances of human sacrifices being offered and that this was pleasing to the gods. Human sacrifices remained customary throughout the historical periods of ancient Greece and down to the time of the Roman emperors. The custom of sacrificing human life to the gods arose undoubtedly from the belief, which under different forms has manifested itself at all times and in all nations, that the nobler the sacrifice and the dearer to the possessor, the more pleasing it would be to the gods. Hence, the frequent instances in Grecian stories of persons sacrificing their own children, something that's even present in the Bible. While civilizations come and go, there are certain practices which seem to remain, sometimes out in the open, and at other times carried out in secret, often by a religious elite, who some have claimed continue rituals involving human sacrifice until this day. The Vatican is the smallest sovereign state in the world. It is governed by the Bishop of Rome, now called the Pope, and with over 1.2 billion followers around the globe, the Catholic Church represents the second most populous religion in the world, after Islam. In 325, Emperor Constantine called the Council of Nicaea in an attempt to unify Christianity. Constantine envisioned Christianity as a religion that could unite the Roman Empire, which at the time was beginning to fragment and divide. While this may have seemed to be a positive development for the Christian Church, the results were anything but positive. Just as Constantine refused to fully embrace the Christian faith, but continued many of his pagan beliefs and practices, so the Christian Church that Constantine promoted was a mixture of true Christianity and Roman paganism, which in many cases continued covertly, in secret, rituals which not only involved sacrifice, but pedophilia and sex orgies, practices which were carried out overtly in ancient Greece and Rome. Of the three major Abrahamic religions, Judaism, Islam, and Christianity, only members of the first two groups, Jews and Muslims, are generally recognized as descendants of Abraham. Could Abraham's descendants also make up a bulk of the Christian world centered in the European continent? While I've already spoken about the Scythians that penetrated into Europe in prior videos, which I'll leave a link to in the description, scholars such as Janet Moser have also turned their attention to the origins of the Druids and Celts, linking them to populations originating in the Mediterranean, writing that, quote, in the Psalter of Cashel, an ancient text written by St. Cormac, it states that the Tuatha Danann ruled in Ireland for about two centuries and were highly skilled in architecture and other arts from their long residence in Greece. The Tuatha Danann were the descendants of Danaus, the son of Belus, who went with his 50 daughters to Argos, the home of his ancestor, Io. In Irish legends, the Tuatha Dé Danann, who were considered to be demigods, were said to have possessed a grail-like vessel. These teachers of wisdom were the founders of the Druidic priesthood.
In the old Celtic Druidic system in Northern Europe, what we would call the white man's established system in Northern Europe, there was a very powerful priesthood called the Celtic Druids. And in the Druidic Celtic system, one of the most important symbols in that system, that ancient system, we're talking about even a 500 to 1,000 years before the Roman Empire, the Celtic Druidic system was in operation in Northern Europe. One of their most important symbols has come down to us today, and that is the magic wand, like Merlin the magician with his magic wand, you know, Mickey Mouse with his, you know, and the conductor of an orchestra with his magic wand, Fantasia. Mm-hmm. The magic wands were always made out of the wood of a holly tree. It was always made out of Hollywood. Consequently, they're still working their magic in Hollywood, because the holly tree, that was very sacred to the ancient magicians, the ancient Celtic Druid magicians. All of our governmental superstructure in America, and listen closely to this, all of our governmental arrangements in America, all of our religious institutions in the Western world, all of our governmental laws, jurisdictional laws, regulations, codes, all of these things which govern the Western civilization are druidic. They are absolutely Celtic druidic system. And unless you understand the Celtic druidic system and the old ancient Egyptian, Sumerian, Babylonian, Phoenician, Canaanite system, understand there's been a huge, enormous amount of material that has been covered up, so that people just go all about their daily business to their synagogues and to churches and never ever question where any of these things are coming from. In the ancient Phoenician Canaanite system, when it finally bled into Europe thousands of years ago, it formed what we call the Celtic Druidic system. The Celtic Druidic system had its origins in the old Phoenician Canaanite system. That whole area we call today Israel and Lebanon, that was called Phoenicia Cana. And consequently, that whole system of the Canaanite religion found its way into Eastern Europe and then into Northern Europe and formed the basis theologically for what came to be known as the Celtic Druidic system. The Celtic Druidic system, one of the most important symbols, and some of you have heard me say this before, one of the most important symbols in the old Celtic Druidic system was a magic wand, like Merlin the magician with his magic wand. That's Celtic Druidic. Magic wands were always made out of holly wood. Okay, and they're still working their magic on us in Hollywood.
The Oxford Dictionary defines a druid as a priest, magician, or soothsayer in the ancient Celtic religion. The common perception today is that the druids were a relatively small and insignificant class of people, and that druidism was an obscure religion, not widely practiced and without influence. This perception is false. The Druid religion directly parallels that of the ancient Israelite priests, from types of sacrifices, mostly documented in the writings of Julius Caesar, to clothing, rituals, and festivals. The Israelites were deeply immersed in the practice of divination and enchantments, which means sorcery or what is today considered witchcraft, fortune-telling, and looking to heavenly signs and omens. In the biblical census of the Book of Numbers, the tribe of Dan is portrayed as the second largest Israelite tribe, after Judah. The most celebrated Danite was Samson, who we discussed earlier. The traditional symbol used to represent Dan is the snake, which incidentally was what was driven out of Ireland by St. Patrick, which is suspicious as Ireland has never had snakes the entire duration of the Holocene. And so the serpent was likely a metaphor for these Israelites, who are also associated with Vikings, whose genetics have also recently been shown to come from Eurasia and the Mediterranean, and who also use the snake symbology, along with the Phoenicians, who I've already covered numerous times in the past. John Eurenius, a Swedish pastor, also connected the Israelites to the Nordic countries in his 1751 book, Atlantica Orientalis, where he theorized that the gods of Norse mythology were deified ancestors from the Levant, who he connected to Israel. Of course, Thor Heyerdahl, the Norwegian ethnographer of Kon-Tiki fame, also speculated that Odin, commonly thought of today as a mythical Norse god, was a historical person who founded the Norwegian-Swedish royal dynasty, leading his people into northern Europe from Eurasia and northern Iran, the Aryan homeland near the Caucasus and Scythian territory. For this, he cited the 13th century work attributed to historian Snorri Sturluson, an Icelandic chieftain. The Swedish coat of arms features lions and three crowns. It's probably safe to say that there are no lions walking around in Sweden, and the symbol was imported, with the extended tongue a clear giveaway to its association to the Lion of Judah. As for the crowns, we already discussed the number 7 and 12 at the start of the presentation. I did not cover the esoteric significance, however, of the number 3 yet, which I will do now. The three mother letters in Hebrew give us a hint in that they represent water, fire, and air. The fire and water represent the male and female polarity, and in antiquity, the moon was actually a male deity, and his consort was Venus. The symbolism can still be seen in the Islamic lunar crescent and star, which leaves the sun as the exalted child. This is the original triune, which is at the core of ancient esoteric occult magic, where the child or sun does not represent a flesh and blood creation, but an astral creation, which then, through sex magic, allegedly manifests in the physical or material world. My name is Robert Sepper. I'm an anthropologist. My published work is available on Amazon, as well as through various other major book outlets. They make a great gift. If you'd like to support my work, you could do that through patreon.com. There should be a link in the description section for those that are interested. Please have a wonderful weekend, and I hope to see you again soon.